Welcome to Angel Oak Capital's Portfolio Manager Insights podcast series. This is Randy Christman, Marketing Director at Angel Oak Capital Advisors. We're here today with Matt Kennedy, who serves as Head of Corporate Credit and a Senior Portfolio Manager at Angel Oak. He is also a Portfolio Manager of the Angel Oak High Yield Opportunities Fund. In part one of this two podcast series, Matt will be explaining high yield bonds, the potential benefits of investing in high yield bonds, and his outlook for high yield bonds over the next 12 to 24 months. With that, Matt, welcome.
Thanks, Randy.
Matt, what are high-yield bonds?
That's a good question to start with. Most corporate bonds are assigned a rating by one or more of the big three credit rating agencies, which are Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch. These bond ratings are classified as either investment grade or below investment grade. Below investment grade is also known as high yield. Investment grade ratings range from AAA, AA+, AA, AA-, A+, A, and so on, all the way down to BBB-. And just for reference purposes, I'm quoting the S&P and Fitch rating nomenclature. S&P and Fitch adopted the plus and minus characteristics, while Moody's adopted a more of a numeric system of a 1, 2, or 3, where using a 1 would be equivalent to a plus on the Fitch and S&P side, and a 3 would be equivalent to a minus. So, for example, a AA1 is equivalent to a AA+, and a Baa3 is equivalent to a BBB-. Anything below investment grade is considered high yield. The highest quality high yield rating is BB+ or Ba1 at Moody's, and scales all the way down similarly to the lowest rating of D for default. Generally speaking, according to the rating agencies, a credit rating reflects the issuer's willingness and capacity to meet its financial commitments as they come due, as well as the structure of the bond, which indicates its priority in the capital structure, which could impact its recovery in the event of default. For example, secured debt ranks higher in the capital structure than subordinated debt and will have a higher recovery in the event of a restructuring, while equity is at the bottom of the capital structure and entitled to the residual or anything left over after satisfying all the priority claims. In terms of the rating, there are many reasons why a company's bonds may be rated below investment grade or high yield. A few examples of characteristics that impact an issuer's capacity to meet its financial commitments resulting in a high yield debt rating include its leverage, how much debt it has on its balance sheet, the ability to meet its debt service, its size or scale, geographic diversification, product diversification, cyclicality, competitive position, liquidity, access to capital. There's a laundry list of reasons why a company could be rated high yield or below investment grade. That said, being rated below investment grade or high yield shouldn't necessarily be considered a bad thing. There are some large, well-known companies that have corporate bonds with high-yield ratings. Some examples are Alcoa, Sprint, T-Mobile, Goodyear Tire, MGM, Netflix, SiriusXM Radio. Those are just a few of the high-yield companies in the high-yield universe.
What are the potential benefits of investing in high-yield bonds?
So the benefits don't come without additional risk. Reflecting their incrementally higher credit risk relative to investment grade bonds, high yield corporate bonds offer a higher yield or greater level of interest income than investment grade corporate bonds. They also have the potential to generate greater capital appreciation if the issuer can improve its credit risk profile, which can lead to credit rating upgrades and improved valuations. Additionally, the current environment of low treasury rates, there's a fear that rates will rise, resulting in negative total returns on fixed income investments in the short term. A potential benefit of high-yield bonds is that their higher yield relative to treasuries or other investment-grade fixed income alternatives, all else equal, has the potential to absorb or mitigate the negative impact of rising rates and still deliver a positive total return. That said, high-yield corporate bonds are incrementally more risky than investment-grade corporate bonds and potentially more susceptible to an economic downturn or other negative event for some of the reasons that we highlighted in the prior answer.
What is your view on the current valuations of the high-yield market?
Currently, our view is that the high-yield market overall appears to be fairly valued to slightly cheap. The credit spread pickup over treasuries right now is approximately 600 basis points, which is essentially at its long-term average. Relative to investment-grade corporate bonds, high yield is trading about 40 basis points cheap to its long-term average of 420 basis points over investment-grade corporate bonds. Prior to the recent volatility earlier this year when the high-yield market sold off, along with the other risk markets like equities and investment-grade corporate bonds, this is the most attractive the high-yield market has been compared to investment-grade going back all the way to 2012. Interestingly, though, the current overall spread valuation for high yield masks the bifurcation that exists within the high yield market. Despite the recent rally off the lows in February, single Bs and triple Cs, which continue to look attractive relative to higher quality double Bs. Recall that double Bs are the highest quality of the high yield corporate bond ratings, and that single B and triple C bonds generally affect incrementally more credit risk or greater degree of risk relative to double Bs. The valuation differential between single Bs and triple Cs relative to the higher quality double Bs hasn't been this wide since 2009. Some of this can be attributed to the commodity sectors like energy and metals and mining, but overall it reflects the cautiousness of investors and the dispersion within the high-yield universe, which provides an opportunity for those that are willing to spend the time and do the work to find the situations where the risk and the reward make sense.
Default rates are low compared to historical standards. Are you concerned about an uptick in defaults, and how would you expect high-yield bonds to perform in a rising default rate environment?
Default rates have increased this year, primarily due to the defaults in the energy and metals and mining sectors. According to J.P. Morgan, year-to-date defaults are 16% higher than the total of all of 2015. Of the total year-to-date, 24 of those are energy and metals and mining issuers, accounting for about 83% of the total defaults. If you exclude the energy and metals and mining sectors, only 13 companies have defaulted. Again, according to J.P. Morgan, as of the end of June, the par-weighted default rate for high yield was 3.56%, up from 1.88% a year ago and up from 1.8% for all of 2015. Excluding the energy and metals and mining sectors, the default rate is only 0.53%, which is extremely low. J.P. Morgan expects the default rate for 2016 to be roughly 6%, and only 2% when you exclude the energy and metals and mining sectors. For comparison purposes, the long-term average par-weighted default rate is about 3.5%. When it comes to the performance, though, the actual default rate is a lagging indicator. A significant increase in the default rate usually follows or lags weak high-yield corporate bond performance. Ideally, the market is forward-looking and anticipates an increase in the default rates before they occur. Fixed income investors are generally pretty conservative on the lookout for bad news in order to preserve capital. The energy and metals and mining sectors, the two sectors accounting for the vast majority of defaults year to date, were the two worst performing sectors last year with negative returns of approximately negative 23.6% and negative 26.2% respectively. In the first half of this year, 2016, those two sectors, the energy and metals and mining sectors, were among the best performing sectors with positive total returns of 22.5% and 26.7% respectively. This was a long way of saying that assuming the U.S. economy doesn't enter a recession over the coming year or there's an unexpected political event, the increase in default rates in 2016 that we're experiencing is expected to be contained to the energy, metals, and mining sectors and shouldn't have a material impact on performance as it's already reflected in valuations.
Are there any specific sectors you find attractive in today's market?
Before I jump into the specific sectors, I want to provide a little bit of background. As I mentioned earlier, we see the high-yield market as attractive at current valuation levels. We also have a positive view on the U.S. economy. That said, we aren't expecting extraordinary growth given the global backdrop. But we do think the economy continued to grow around the 2% area, plus or minus a quarter percent or so. Supporting our outlook is the low level of unemployment. Unemployment's currently around 4.9%. We have a healthy pace of new job creation. Over the last 12 months, we've generated new jobs of about 2.4 million, which is definitely on the high side, looking back historically. Wages are moving in the right direction, if ever so slowly. The consumer appears to be in a relatively strong position with household leverage at the lowest level since 2002. Bank lending continues to grow at a high single-digit pace of about 7.5% or so year over year. Home values continue to appreciate, at a respectable pace of over 5% year over year. Gasoline prices remain relatively low, supporting consumer spending. Gasoline prices right now on a national basis are averaging about $2.25 per gallon versus an average of about $3.32 from 2011 to 2014. So definitely subsidizing disposable income for the consumer. From a global perspective, China's government continues to provide enough support to keep the economy from falling into recession. They just reported 2Q GDP of about 6.7%, which is flat with the first quarter. They also reported strong retail sales growth for June, up about 10.6% year over year, compared to 10% in May. And industrial production for June was up 6.2% compared to 6% in May. So they still have to deal with the transition from an export-dependent economy to a consumer-driven economy. But the fear that we experienced earlier this year that China could fall into recession appears to have been overdone. The eventual impact of the recent decision by the United Kingdom to separate from the European Union is still unknown, but it will take years to negotiate and implement, dampening the impact as the market will have time to adjust to whatever those changes will be. In that context, the sectors where we currently have the largest overweights include financial services, capital goods, basic industries, energy, transportation, and automotive. These are some of the more cyclically sensitive sectors that we expect to benefit in this type of environment.
Do you think the worst is over for oil and gas and metals and mining?
Energy is one of the sectors where we do currently have an overweight. However, our positioning is on the defensive side. Energy can be broken down into four subsectors: exploration and production. Those are the companies that find and produce the oil and gas. Oil field services. Those are the companies that own and operate the drilling rigs and or provide supplies and services to facilitate the drilling for oil and gas. Gas distribution. Those are the companies that own and operate the pipelines. And lastly, the refining and marketing sector. And those are the companies that refine and produce and sell the gasoline. We are currently underweight the exploration and production companies and more weighted towards the pipeline and refiners. So unless we experience a negative event or shock that sends the global economy into recession, we do think that we've seen the worst when it comes to the recent price performance for crude oil. I think it bottomed at around 26, 21 in the first quarter, sometime in February. The U.S. oil and gas industry is being viewed as the swing producer and the most sensitive to price relative to OPEC and some national oil companies. With U.S. oil drilling rig counts down to the lowest level since 2009, production has been declining since mid-2015, and inventories, which actually continued to rise, hit historic highs this spring and actually started to roll over in May. This last point is providing support for prices. That was the last point in the market that needed to turn, and it's providing support for prices from a supply and demand perspective. As for the metals and mining sector, that's being mostly driven by China. The major iron ore producers essentially extrapolated demand growth in China and increased their supplies accordingly. The combination of sluggish global economy and reduced demand for Chinese exports, a slowdown in the Chinese construction and infrastructure spending, excess Chinese manufacturing capacity in areas like steel, coupled with the intent to transition from an export economy to more of a consumption-based economy with increased supplies of raw materials, has resulted in a difficult environment for the metals and mining sector. Weak producers are going out of business currently, and China is slowly reducing excess capacity in industries like steel. And that said, there are bright spots. For example, U.S. steel manufacturers have recently won trade cases against countries dumping steel in the U.S. This should lead to higher prices and improved margins and cash flow for domestic steel producers.
What is the driver in today's market for most new issuance? Is it operating capital related, refinancing, or expanding through debt instead of equity?
Since the financial crisis, it's actually been a pretty disciplined new issue market, which is positive from a credit fundamentals perspective. It also supports the adage that moderately growing economy is supportive of credit markets and that it doesn't permit companies to get out of hand when it comes to, you know, debt-financed activities that would be detrimental to their balance sheets and credit profiles. According to J.P. Morgan, from 2000 to 2014, refinancing has accounted for approximately 58% of the new issue volume, compared to 38% for the 3 years preceding the financial crisis. Acquisition and LBO financing over the same period, 2009 through 2014, accounted for only 20% of the new issue volume, which is less than half of the volume of the mid-2000s and late 1980s, for example. The long-term average is about 24% for acquisition and LBO financing. Access to capital markets became easier in 2015, and refinancing dropped to 43% from the average of 58% from 2009 to 2014, and acquisition financing increased to 38%. However, that changed in 2016. Year to date, the percentages are 54% and 19% respectively for refinancing and acquisition financing as the market has become more disciplined again, which was triggered by the heightened fears of recession and deterioration in the commodity sectors earlier this year.
What is your outlook for high-yield bonds over the next 12 to 24 months?
At the moment, we have a positive outlook for the high-yield market. Valuations overall are in line with historical averages and look undervalued when looking beyond the safest issuers. At a high level, single Bs and triple Cs appear to offer some of the most attractive relative valuations within the high-yield market, going all the way back to 2009 when the high-yield market was rallying post the financial crisis. And the economic backdrop currently appears supportive, with unemployment strong, wages ticking up, household leverage and spending capacity at their best levels since 2002, gas prices relatively low. And in that context, we expect GDP to be around 2%, which is good, but not great. This type of modest environment has historically been very positive for investing in corporate bonds. The economy is strong enough that companies have the potential to gradually improve their credit profiles, but not strong enough where they have easy access to the credit and are able to finance M&A that leverages their balance sheet.
Matt, thanks for your time today. We look forward to part two of the High Yield Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Randy.